Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at Graymere Church of Christ.
Isaiah 25, although we'll be looking at other passages as well as we continue our journey through the book. I mentioned earlier that we do have a large number of our young people that are at the area-wide, and so we're thankful for that and for the connection that happens there, the spiritual growth that happens there. We're also thankful for this past weekend. We had our first kind of what we're calling open door Sundays, and it was a great time for us to be together. I'm almost afraid to start listing names of how many people were involved in making everything happen for fear that I'd leave someone out. But thank you to all those who made that possible. The Fried Hardeman Chorale traveled to be here with us. And so I'm very thankful for that, especially thankful to Jack Malone. Right now, the Fried Hardeman Chorale does not have a bus that everyone can fit in and ride. And so we were able to give them a ride both there and back, and so grateful for that. On Saturday evening, they had a performance that was hosted on the campus of Columbia Academy, and so a lot of folks from area congregations got to be there. That was a real blessing. And then to all of you who housed our singers, I'm just so thankful for you being willing to do that. In college, I have a lot of great memories of traveling with a chorus singing group and a lot of memories of staying in people's homes, and that makes a big impact and a big impression. And so for those of you that did that, thank you for making that possible. And we had a wonderful day together Sunday. If you didn't get a chance to hear the chorale sing, I know that was on our live stream, so you could probably go to our YouTube page and find that. But that was a real blessing, especially I enjoyed watching the faces of the children during the children's medley, getting to be part of it, and that was really neat. Well, not only did we host the chorale, but we also ended up hosting a lot of the family members and friends of the chorale, because this past couple of months has been the first time that they've been able to tour since the COVID pandemic. And so there are a lot of parents that hadn't had the chance to hear their children sing before. So they were a part of that. That was great. And then we had an incredible opportunity to celebrate the Lila's baptism as we got to watch her decision. We're thankful for Lila Owens, and we know you'll want to continue to encourage her and the whole family for Laylee and for Tim and Amber. We're just so grateful for all they do for our congregation, and especially to get to share a moment like that. Then we had a meal together, and many of you brought a potluck meal and food to be part of that. Thankful especially for Rick and Hope Whitley and John and Lena Compton and so many others who made the setup possible for that. It just really was a blessing all the way around. And it was pretty neat, too, just from a Graymere perspective. I was going to say a selfish perspective, but I guess if it's a Graymere perspective, it can't be too selfish. But to see Amanda Robinson as part of the chorale singing, and it's pretty neat that we had at the time when everyone could come up and sing if you'd been in a chorus before, that we had a lot of folks here that could come up and do that, but it was also neat to see Christopher up here and that connection. And so there's just a lot that we had that we could be grateful for this past weekend, and I'm just thankful for the opportunities we're having to reach out and to connect with other people. I will remind us, because it's a little out of the way, where we placed the door for our theme for an open door. We put it a little bit out of the way. We were trying to put it in a place where maybe it wouldn't be too tempting to keep walking through it, you know, to open the door and walk through it. So we kind of put it up against the wall there. But I would encourage you to sign that if you haven't already. That's just all that is a reminder for us that sometime this year, I want to try something. I want to walk through a door of opportunity that God's opened up to me to try a new way of ministry, to try maybe something I hadn't been part of before. I've already had multiple people who have shared with me specific things that they're thinking about doing this year. That's really exciting. We want to continue to do that. And so I hope we can be part of that as we grow together. We've been going through the book of Isaiah on Sunday nights. And there's a challenge that comes when you're looking at any book of prophecy, but especially a book as large as Isaiah. There are 66 chapters in Isaiah. And so as we've mentioned, some have looked at it as the Bible in miniature, because just like the Bible has 66 books, Isaiah has 66 chapters. And there do seem to be sections of it. Chapters 1 through 39 seem to deal with one span of time, and chapters 40 through 66 seem to have another focus. And so it's kind of like the difference between the Old and the New Testaments. And so as we've walked through Isaiah, we've tried to look at a couple of themes, and we won't be able to go in every chapter in detail, but what I'd like for us to try to do is look at maybe the section of Isaiah that we're in and take a bird's eye view of what's happening. Because one of the challenges we have, and maybe you found this when you've been reading through the Bible, is because we're not a part of exactly what was taking place then, we're not as familiar with the names of the rulers and the nations that they're dealing with. All of a sudden, it kind of starts to blend together. And we go from one chapter to the next, and now we're talking about the Babylonians, and we were talking about the Assyrians, and now we've got Ethiopia, and here's Egypt, and here's this and that, and it kind of all becomes just one big conglomeration. It's hard for us to really focus on understanding each individual step, and it might be a challenge for us to preach a series of sermons. If we did one sermon on every chapter of Isaiah, that would be 66 Sunday night sermons. I'm not saying it wouldn't be a good thing, but you may be ready for another book of the Bible after we get to about 30 or 40 of those. And so what I've tried to do for tonight is to help us take a bird's eye view of what's happening as we come to the end of that first section we might think of chapters 1 through 39, and then as we prepare for chapters 40 through 66. Now, one of the things you notice when you go through the book of Isaiah is it's not necessarily in chronological order. We're used to seeing things in chronological order. I'm used to reading something in chronological order. I begin here, and then we go here, and then this happens, and this happens. But when you get to Isaiah, what seems to be the beginning of Isaiah's commissioning, that shows up in Isaiah 6. If we were expecting something strictly in chronological order, we'd expect that to be at the very beginning. But that scene in the throne room where Isaiah is in the presence of God and says, "Here I am, send me," that comes in chapter 6. And so what we're seeing here is prophecy that's arranged more along the lines of the theme, the message that the prophet is giving, rather than a play-by-play of each day. Isaiah did this, then he did this, and then he did this. And so that's important for us to keep in mind. We came to chapter 12 a couple of weeks ago, and that ends kind of a portion of Isaiah. And then when we start in chapter 13, we start a section that some have called Oracles Against the Nations. And all that means is you've got prophecies that are not just for God's people, but they're for other nations. So it's important for us to keep in mind that context. As we get started, I want us to think about something that took place in Colorado at the turn of the 19th century into the 20th century. In 1870s and in the 1880s, Colorado had benefited from a lot of the mining boom that had created a lot of jobs in that area, a lot of excitement. The mining industry even developed some millionaires. People became very wealthy. And one of the towns that had really benefited from that was Leadville, Colorado. But when you get to about the 1890s, that starts to wane a little bit. And all of a sudden, there are some laws passed that aren't quite as beneficial to miners, and all of a sudden, that wealth seems to dry up. And so you have some towns that had been built during that boom that are trying to figure out, how are we going to keep going? How are we going to continue to bring in money? And so one real estate developer decided that the city of Leadville should host a winter carnival. And the centerpiece of this winter carnival would be a giant ice palace. Now, these are things that had been developed in Canada and in parts of Minnesota, And so you would have it, it depends on what you're looking at, but you'd have maybe a wooden structure and then blocks of ice that are around that wooden structure. And then you might have some sculptors that come in and make things look, incredibly fancy or ornate. But the idea was, let's build something that could be a tourist attraction. And we'll have an ice palace that we'll build, and there'll be a place you can go ice skating in there, and you can pay admission and have some hills that you could sled down or toboggan down, and we'll have a restaurant there, and you can go in the ice palace restaurant, and we'll make so much money. We'll have people who will come in to stay, and this will be a real centerpiece. And the idea was, you build the building, and then you could have you have the ice palace during the winter. You have a wooden structure year-round to have some arenas and some events in. And so there were some fundraising that was done. And in 1895, people began to raise money. They found a spot near downtown where they could build this. And the hope was that this could be something that happened every year, and you had a wooden structure around it for the rest of the year. Horse-drawn sleds began carrying huge blocks of ice, where ice cutters are shaping them for construction. And as they put them together, they'd use water almost like mortar as it freezes to the ice. When it finally opened, there was a lot of attention initially, but they had a hard time making money. They found that people would come up for the day, sometimes with a sack lunch, just to check out the ice sculpture, but they wouldn't buy any food there. They wouldn't stay the night, and then they'd go home. So anything, obviously, made of ice is eventually going to melt. So when spring came, they hadn't made very much money. It wasn't going to be feasible to do all year round. It was eventually something that now exists in history as a kind of a reminder of something that started out very promising, but then when the sun comes out and it melts, all of a sudden it's not quite living up to its potential. Now, we know if you're thinking about an ice castle, that anything that's made of ice is eventually going to melt. It's going to be temporary. It's the same kind of feeling that you have if you go to the beach and you put together an incredible sandcastle, and maybe you spend a long time digging things out and getting things just right. But you know when the tide comes in, you know by the next day, chances are that sandcastle is going to be gone. And so all that you've worked on is eventually the next day not even going to be there. We're used to things like that are temporary. But it's interesting, there are some things in our mind that we treat as if when I build this, this is going to be permanent. This is going to be lasting. It's hard for us to see beyond our own lives. It's hard for us to see beyond our own sphere of influence. But a lot of times we're walking around on an earth that's temporary, looking at things that are temporary, but maybe treating them, maybe falling in the trap of treating them as if they're permanent. And sometimes that can happen even with nations and with governments. So why is that important if we're going to be looking at Isaiah? It's important because Isaiah is a prophet who doesn't just have a message for God's people, but has a message for other nations. And these other nations at the time, some of them were very powerful. At the time, it would have seemed outlandish to claim that some of them are going to be defeated, especially for a prophet from the tribes of Judah to stand up and say, you guys aren't going to last another year, another 2 years. To make statements like that, this guy from this small nation of Judah that's not nearly as powerful as Babylon or Assyria, and he's going to tell us what's happening? We're tempted to think that the structures that we've built, maybe even the nations that we're part of, are permanent. But in reality, any kingdom on earth is temporary. Now, I'm thankful for the country in which I live, which I was born. I'm thankful for the time and the place which I was born at. That's something I thank God for on a regular basis. And I hope that all of us would feel the same way. But we also realize that even the country that we enjoy and benefit from living in is not going to last forever. When we're part of the kingdom of God, we're a part of the only kingdom that will be eternal. So what do we see when we're looking in Isaiah? There's a word that's given to the world here, not just to God's people, but to the whole world. And that reminds us that God doesn't have just something to say to the church, but to the world. So we're going to look at one passage in Isaiah 25, but we're going to be thinking about some of the things that happened in the earlier chapters. But these four verses of Isaiah 25 give us a glimpse into some of these principles. Now, as we look through what happens starting in chapter 13, you have these oracles against the nations. And then when you get to chapters 24 through 27, that's kind of seems to be a unit that seems to really be summing up what has been said to all of these different nations with the praise to God and with his power over creation. So in verse 1 of Isaiah 25, O Lord, you are my God. I will exalt you. I will give thanks to your name, for you have worked wonders, plans formed long ago with perfect faithfulness. For you have made a city into a heap, a fortified city into a ruin. A palace of strangers is a city no more. It will never be rebuilt. Therefore, a strong people will glorify you. Cities of ruthless nations will revere you. For you have been a defense for the helpless, a defense for the needy in his distress, a refuge from the storm, a shade from the heat. For the breath of the ruthless is like a rainstorm against a wall. Now, I want us to pause right here and then to think back to see what's happened before we get to this message in Isaiah 25. There are a few things that these chapters teach us. One of those is that nations are temporary, but God's rule, God's eternal rule, is permanent. So God has a message for all of these nations. And without reading each of the chapters, I just want us to think a little bit about each of the messages that is sent. So starting in chapter 13, God has a message for Babylon. And there's more than one place where a message to Babylon shows up for Isaiah. Ultimately, this is the nation that will be the downfall of Judah. When you have the nation of Israel divided into northern and southern kingdoms, Israel is those 10 tribes of the north. They're taken in by Assyria. But Babylon is the kingdom that takes the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. And so ultimately, Babylon's going to be the downfall of Judah. But eventually, Babylon is going to fall to the Medes. And we can look through books like Daniel and see that first Daniel serving under the Babylonian Empire, but then it's the Medo-Persian Empire that comes in, and they take over. Now, as we think of this description, Isaiah says that Babylon would be as helpless, as a woman in childbirth, describing someone in the pains of labor. What if someone were to come in as an individual is delivering a child, as a woman is delivering a child? What if someone were to come in? He said, that's the same way it's going to be for Babylon. They're not going to be able to fight against the Medes. It also includes kind of a taunt of the Babylonians, a dirge in sort of the form of a song. And the reason I bring that up is because the king of Babylon is described as the morning star. And some have looked at this passage and seen connections maybe with the origin of Satan. And so it's just helpful for us to see what's the immediate context. Well, the context here was Babylon and the king of Babylon. That's what is focused on. The king is going to be cast down. Later on, the cry for Babylon will be, "Fallen is Babylon, this great and impressive and important nation." At the time in which Isaiah says this, it doesn't seem like it would be reality, but it will happen. Then you have Assyria. This is another one of the major world powers at the time, and God is predicting that he would break them. There are only a few verses that are dedicated to Assyria, but the overwhelming message is, if God has planned something, who can frustrate it? In other words, if God has said something is going to happen, no matter how terrible and how fierce the Assyrians might have been, they weren't going to be able to stand up against him. And then you have, in chapter 14, an address to Philistia. We think about the Philistines, and this one seems to be different than other oracles or other prophecies because it's connected to a specific date. It's the year that King Ahaz died. And we've noticed that some in Isaiah's prophecy, that a lot of times those prophecies will be connected to the date that a king dies. That would have been a big deal. That would have been a way to mark that time. But it wasn't just the year that King Ahaz died. It was also the same year the ruler of Assyria, a Assyrian ruler named Tiglath-Pileser III, died. Justin Rogers a few years ago was with us, and he teaches at Fried Hardeman, and was talking about Isaiah at our preaching workshop. And he said, whenever he talks about Tiglath-Pileser III, he said, we just call him TP3. He said, that's just the easier way to do it. This is TP3 as we go through it. Well, he was a major ruler of Assyria, TP3. So he's a major ruler there. So he dies. Well, that's going to cause the Philistines to rejoice, because one of the things they were worried about, all these nations are worried about, you've got Assyria, and you've got Babylon, what are they going to do? And whose side am I going to be on? But Isaiah gives a message to them. He says, you don't need to rejoice with what happened to Assyria. You're going to deal with famine. You're going to deal with other punishment. There will be worse oppression in store. So then we move on to Moab, chapters 15 and 16. These are the descendants of Lot in the Old Testament. The Moabites lived east of the Dead Sea. And you may remember a few weeks ago, when we were talking about different artifacts that have to do with Isaiah, the Moabite stone was one of those. It's that earliest reference to Yahweh that we have outside of Scripture. Well, that's it's on display at the Louvre. It's the biggest monument from this Moabite nation. Moab is described as a nation with cries of distress. Their fate will come in 3 years. Then Damascus is mentioned, a chief city in the area which would later become Syria, which is constantly at war with Israel. That fortified city of Damascus is going to be removed. Ethiopia is a land that's described as a land of insects sending messengers by the Nile, that God is going to do some pruning of this area. The people of Ethiopia would be left as prey to the birds on the mountain or the beasts of the field. It's interesting in the Oracle to Ethiopia that one of the statements that's made is a pronouncement that they will bring an offering or bring a gift to Judah. And when we look through 2 Chronicles 32, there's a time when God gives Hezekiah protection, and all of these, you know, Assyria's trying to attack them, he gives Hezekiah protection, and other nations bring gifts to him. So maybe that's a fulfillment of this. Maybe it's in anticipation of this. Then we have Egypt, who we're a little bit more familiar with, at least from earlier parts of the Old Testament. This is an oracle against the idols of Egypt. Now, God has already shown his power over the idols of Egypt. When we look through the 10 plagues in Scripture, one of the interesting things about the 10 plagues that happen is that God is showing his power over the Nile River, sometimes treated almost like a god, or there were gods over the river and the water. Well, God can turn the river to blood. When there are insects that were sometimes treated as a god, there's a god over these insects, God's the one in control. God's the one in control of the cattle. God's the one in control of life or death. And so one by one, through each of these plagues, God is showing his power over the idols. Well, here again, we see power over the other gods of Egypt. And it seems to be a constant temptation for the Israelites and for Judah to look to Egypt for help, Egypt for guidance. But Isaiah reminds them not to do that. We have Edom and Arabia that are mentioned. Edom is the nation that descended from Esau, and it's further dealt with later in the book as an object of God's wrath. Sacrificial imagery, where Edom is the sacrifice that's being punished. It's also interesting to note that Arabia is threatened with punishment that would happen 1 year after this took place. And then Tyre is described. We usually think about Tyre in association with Sidon, but you have this this description of Tyre that's almost synonymous with sin and with rebellion, described as a harlot, an image we see later in Revelation. So when we're looking through the words of the prophet, and we get to Isaiah 25, and Isaiah is describing how the fact that these once powerful fortified cities are now destroyed, and we look at these different nations and see the way in which God is more powerful than the nations, you might be thinking, okay, well, this is interesting, I guess, but it's kind of depressing. I mean, here we are on a Sunday night studying Isaiah, And now we have to just see all the destruction that was happening to these other nations. That's kind of depressing. And it was an important message. A lot of times prophets had to deliver news that wasn't good. And Isaiah was called to do that. But it's a reminder for us as well that there is no nation that's going to be permanent. Imagine if you lived in one of these places. If you'd grown up in one of these places. If your parents had grown up and their parents before them. If this was a place where your heritage was and it was hard for you to imagine what life outside this nation would be. Isaiah reminds us that only God's rule is eternal. Everything else is temporary. Some of the names on the screen were more powerful than others. Some of the nations lasted longer than others. But none of them were going to be eternal. That's important for us to realize. That nations are temporary. God's rule is permanent. But connected with that, leaders are unpredictable. But God is reliable. One of the things that happens when prophets are on the scene is they keep having to address different kings and different leaders. And both the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah had plenty of kings. And many of them, most of them, didn't do what was right. And so the prophets had a big job. They had to speak truth even to those who were in power. Sometimes leaders, even those who were raised up in the right way, choose to do something wrong. There are other times when we see leaders, even foreign leaders like Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon, who at times all of a sudden seems to do things right, that are glorifying God, seems convinced at times who the true God is. Leaders are unpredictable, but God is reliable. And that matters because if you're like me and you start watching or keeping up with things that are happening on the news, things that are happening on a political, worldwide scale, it can be easy to get discouraged. I mean, I won't ask for a show of hands for any of us who've ever been discouraged by something a political leader has said or by something a leader in our nation has said, but sometimes that can be very discouraging. And so it's good for us to be involved and try to help in whatever way possible, but it's also good to know that no matter what our leaders might do, God is reliable. And so no matter what happens in each time that we live in each age, if we can stick with God, he's going to continue to be reliable. William Ralph Inge was famous for saying, "Whoever marries the spirit of this age will find himself a widower in the next." In other words, if I become so enamored with one specific time, one specific era, one specific period, that's going to change. I don't need to try to cast my anchor during a specific time because the times, things are going to change. Things are going to be different. Sometimes we have the temptation, and it's kind of a nostalgic one to say, well, you know, things were better back in this time, or things were better maybe even for the church back in this era, and I understand that. But the times are going to be unpredictable. Only God is going to be reliable. So I don't need to get caught up in one time period, and I don't need to get caught up in trying to chase the current fads or the current generation or what's going on right now to the point that I'm losing sight of who really is reliable. We'll be able to reach people no matter what the era around us is if we're anchored in God and his word. And so leaders are unpredictable. Things are going to change, but ultimately God is who we rely on. And then another reminder that Isaiah gives us, that enemies will be defeated. God will be victorious. This may be one of the hardest ones for us to keep in mind because it is so easy to feel like the enemies that we face have the upper hand. When we're dealing with something that's hurtful, when we're dealing with grief or with anger, with anxiety, If something has us just really down, if we're really struggling with something, one of the challenges is you wake up in the morning and you're dealing with this and you think, I am always going to have to face this, that there will never be a time that I won't have to deal with this. And the reason that's hard is because there are some things that do stick with us. And while each day is different, we're still facing these same challenges. Isaiah reminds us that there will be a time, And it might not even be this side of eternity, but there will be a time when every enemy will be defeated. It doesn't matter how powerful an enemy seems to be right now to me. And it might seem overwhelming. Every enemy will be defeated. I think that's worth remembering. And so when Isaiah is able to say these fortified cities that were once standing have now collapsed, and the anger that people had against God and the attacks of these people are just sort of like rain against a wall, it just isn't going to penetrate because God is going to be victorious. One of the things that happens in Isaiah 24 through 27 is there's a lot of imagery that when you read it is going to sound familiar. Isaiah is going to talk about God wiping a tear from every eye. Now, where have we heard that before? How does that sound familiar? Well, there are a lot of images there that show up in the book of Revelation. Why would the book of Revelation, why would John, as he receives this vision, call on so many of these images from Isaiah? Because both Isaiah and Revelation are carrying the message that God is victorious, that God wins. And for Isaiah, he's not just dealing with what's happening right in front of him. He's dealing with things that haven't happened yet. But it doesn't matter what's going to happen yet, that God will be victorious. My life is going to change. My attitude is going to change if I really believe that, if I really live like I believe it. Good question for us to ask ourselves tonight. Do we really believe that God will be victorious? Do we really believe that enemies will be defeated? As we look at this section of chapters, Isaiah 24 through 27, there's some imagery that Isaiah uses in chapter 27 of Israel as the vineyard of God. Judah is the vineyard of God. Now, that might sound familiar because in Isaiah chapter 5, he described them as a vineyard. That's a pretty common image for God's people in the prophets. Jeremiah uses it, Isaiah uses it, that there's a vineyard, And so when we think about God's people associated with a vineyard, and then we go over to the New Testament, and Jesus talks about being the true vine, and the branches are connected to him, or he tells a parable about a vineyard owner that comes in. You can see the connections here. Well, what happens in Isaiah 27 is that vineyard in Isaiah 5 that had been so unworthy, he comes back to that image and talks about the worthiness of that vineyard. Now you have Israel, the people of God, described in a positive way. Not because of their victory, but because of God's victory. Nations are temporary. Leaders are unpredictable. Enemies will eventually be defeated. But the through line through all of this is that God is going to have a permanent reign. That God is reliable and that God will be victorious. Now, just because we can look at our lives and see the temporary nature of them, just because we could even look at kingdoms and say, eventually, it might not melt quite as quickly as an ice palace will, but eventually it will be no more. That doesn't mean we're not a part of them. It doesn't mean we're not working to try to do the best we can, where we can, and serving God and blessing the lives of others. It just means that we can do that knowing that God will see us through and we can rely on him. It may be tonight that you need to make your life right with God. Chances are, this is not the only time you've been in a room like this, and probably not the only time you've heard an invitation like this one. But what's a blessing about that is the truth of God that's constantly reliable has been reliable every time this invitation has been offered. And the invitation isn't from us, it's from the God who created us, who sent his Son to die for us. If you want to put Christ on in baptism, if you want to begin living a life that's seeking to glorify him and to serve him, you can do that. It may be that there are other issues that you're dealing with that you could use help and encouragement. We'd love to pray with you and for you in any way that we can. Let's be determined to be a subject of the true King and to be one who's serving in the eternal kingdom. If there's any way we can help you, please come as we stand. As we sing together.